Good afternoon, and welcome to the Fireside Chats of the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society, broadcast on www.sechistorical.org. I'm Teresa Gabaldone, Lyle T. Alverson Professor of Law at the George Washington University School of Law, and moderator for the Fireside Chats. The SEC Historical Society preserves and shares the history of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and of the securities industry through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum's collections are free and accessible worldwide at all times. The virtual museum and archive, as well as the society, is separate and independent of the SEC and receives no government funding. We thank Pfizer, Inc. for its continuing generous sponsorship of the 2008 Fireside Chat season. Its support, along with gifts and grants from many other institutions and individuals, make possible the growth and outreach of the virtual museum and archive. From now through next May, the Fireside Chats will be part of the Society's commemoration of the upcoming 75th anniversary of the SEC in 2009. Each chat will consider the distinctive history and work of one of the major SEC divisions and offices. Our Fireside Chat today looks at the SEC Office of International Affairs. I'm delighted to welcome Michael Mann of Richards Kibbe & Orby, LLP, the first director of the SEC Office of International Affairs, and Dr. Felice Batlin, Assistant Professor of Law, Chicago Kent Law School. Dr. Batlin is the curator of the Virtual Museum and Archives Next Gallery, the Imperial SEC, the SEC and International Securities Regulation, opening on December 1st. This chat will be linked to the gallery. The remarks made by today's speakers are solely their own and do not represent the opinions of the Society. Our speakers cannot give legal or investment advice. Before we begin our discussion, I'd like to encourage our listeners, after the broadcast, to access Michael Mann's oral history interview in the Virtual Museum and Archive, which he conducted with Wayne Carroll in June 2005. It's available in audio, podcast, and transcript formats. I want to start the chat today with a quote from Michael's interview. "None of the fears that this Office of International Affairs would take over and start dictating international policy ever came to pass. It was always collegially run. And, in fact, the efforts to negotiate were so much more bolstered by the fact that when a foreign country would come in to sit with us, they'd be sitting with a senior enforcement official, a senior international official, somebody who knew the markets better than anyone else, and someone who knew the corporate side better than anyone else, that it really played to the SEC's greatest strengths." Michael and Felice, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm hoping that one of you could get us started today by describing, in general terms, the mission of the OIA.
Well, I think the mission of the OIA was really to be a facilitator within the agency for dealing with international issues, for helping to identify emerging international issues, and working collegially with the rest of the agency's staff in developing and formulating solutions or proposals that could be made for working on those kinds of issues.
Where would you find a facilitator like that on the organizational chart of the SEC?
The office reported to the chairman, as all the other offices did, and was part. The director of the office was a member of the senior staff of the agency. So if you view the organizational chart, it's essentially a flat organization with each office and division reporting independently up.
If I can ask you actually a question here, what was the impetus for its creation?
Well, I think that it was a decision that was made by Richard Breeden in when he first came to the commission. I think basically we had, when he first arrived, spent about 2 weeks traveling in Europe, signed the Memorandum of Understanding with the Netherlands, signed the Memorandum of Understanding with the French, and met with the British regulators to talk about Big Bang and what was going on in the British market. And at that time, I think Richard Breeden, Linda Quinn, and I were together on this trip in meeting with people. And when we came back, Richard's reaction was one of, we need to have a centralized place for dealing with the sort of panoply of issues that we're dealing with. At that time, I was the associate director in the Division of Enforcement and most of the relationships that had been developed had really been built on the need to gather information internationally. We had gotten to know the regulators or the people who are emerging as regulators as a result of our proposing to them that they cooperate with us and share information with us. And that Richard Breeden came back and said, that's the fulcrum, but it is not the entire game. And we shouldn't be running what is essentially a marketplace that is internationalizing out of just simply from an enforcement point of view. Rather, we should use enforcement as the tool for thinking about all of these other issues as well.
I would say one of the things that I find looking through the history is that, in fact, it was through the question of raising capital and disclosure issues that you see in the 40s and the 50s much more than any concern with enforcement issues, and that the SEC from a very, very early time, actually from the 30s onward, was constantly meeting with foreign issuers as well as foreign governments. So it's a slightly different model that sort of comes out of the 80s like that.
Very interesting. Now, you've mentioned the 80s, you've mentioned Richard Breeden, you've mentioned the Big Bang, and Michael, we know that you were the first director, and you don't look all that old. So what you're really talking about for getting the OIA up and running?
OIA was created in December of 1989.
And that actually seems quite recent. Why do you think it took that long?
Well, I think that really it wasn't until that period that the SEC was both identifying international issues that it had an interest in, looking outward, and also identifying issues that it had an interest in terms of protecting its own market. If you think of markets as being, you know, purely territorial, the New York Stock Exchange, you know, was accessible by people putting orders in on it. There weren't electronic exchanges. There wasn't information as widely available electronically. There weren't investors, international investors, in the same way that there were as began to emerge in the 80s. I wouldn't say it was the beginning, but I think that you saw a real coalescing around the idea that the American capital market was just beginning to burgeon at that point in terms of being a place that offered funding and capital, that offered a trading market that was liquid and well-regulated, and was being recognized as a place to come. Outside of the United States, there was universal banking. There weren't investment banks. When you raised capital, you were raising them by taking out loans. Your investors didn't have a stake in your success. They rather had a stake in getting their interest back. And I think that it, as we moved into an equity culture, that had a lot to do with internationalization going beyond the U.S. borders, both from an investor point of view and from a capital-raising point of view. The United States had the capital, it had the investors, it had the expertise, it had the instruments. There were no options traded outside of the United States, listed options. That was something that had been innovated in the late 60s and came to pass in 1975. So there were a lot of things that came together in the 80s, in addition to international interest, that I think caused there to be a need for more coordination. One thing I think, and my guess is that there'll be other comments on this. The SEC had people that worked on international things for years before the office was created.
Specialists?
Not just specialists, but there were people in every department that dealt with particular international issues. And even the enforcement division, there had been Foreign Corrupt Practices Act cases, and one of the earliest cases in terms of subpoena enforcement, the Artemisa case, you know, was brought in the 40s. So the SEC had done international things throughout its existence. I think the real difference was the recognition that there was a real opportunity and a need to have a more coordinated approach and for people to work on that coordinated approach.
And we have a slight disagreement here, and I think it's slight, but I think that there were quite a few historical precedents, actually, for the office. And though the ADC's an incredible boom in the market and in the pace of internationalization, my argument is, in fact, that it's been there since the 40s as the United States emerged as the principal creditor nation after World War II. There was a man by the name of Walter Lauchheim, who worked for the SEC in the 1940s, who was actually the foreign economic advisor and who coordinated foreign requests to the SEC about disclosure, as well as participated in Bretton Woods and all the major conferences regarding international funding. And he was the SEC's man. And so we can sort of see this and Michael's position as, in fact, having some historical precedent.
Very interesting. You know, to someone who's not all, who was not all that familiar with the agency, perhaps it might occur to think, oh, it's the State Department that traditionally has been responsible for representing U.S. interests vis-a-vis foreign countries. Could one of you tell us something about relations with the State Department when OIA was in its infancy?
Well, I think that really you should start with what was the relationship of the SEC and the State Department.
Excellent.
The SEC always viewed itself as an independent agency because that's what it is. And the State Department is not an independent agency. It works for the president and represents the foreign policy of the United States. The SEC exists for the protection of investors on the U.S. markets, regardless of nationality. And as a result, the SEC has, I think, in its history, brought a fairly large number of cases that, from a foreign policy perspective, may not have been the most convivial from a State Department point of view. And the State Department really never had any voice in that, at least during the years that I was there. It was a matter of obviously seeking their advice, and they were experts in foreign policy. But they weren't experts in securities matters. And so when the SEC first started negotiating with foreign countries, there was a question, well, what is the relationship with the State Department? And the conclusion was, obviously, when we go to a foreign country, we are officials of the United States, even if we're independent, and we need to have the support and cooperation of the ambassadors and the embassies there, but that we are there for our own discussions because these are not government-to-government discussions. These are discussions about policy. There are some interesting things that shoot off from that in that, for example, the agreements the SEC negotiated were by choice memoranda of understanding. They are not agreements which require the consent of the executive to be entered into. There's only one, there are actually two agreements that I'm aware of that the SEC has ever entered into. The first one, with the French and with the Dutch, because at the time, to make them work, the Dutch said, for us to be able to enforce what you want under this agreement, it must be passed as a law. And so the MOU of 1989 with the Kingdom of the Netherlands is actually with the Kingdom of the Netherlands and was enacted into law as the legislation for implementing it. And it required the consent of the executive to enter into it. It is regarded in the United States as a memorandum of understanding, but in Holland it's regarded as an international agreement, and it's recorded as such at the State Department.
If I can, again, provide a little sort of historical background, one of the wonderful documents I found the other day was, in fact, a letter from Jerome Frank to the Secretary of State Hull at that time, speaking about Chinese securities, Chinese bonds that were being sold in the United States in 1939, which of course becomes a very famous Chinese benevolent case. And in the letter, Frank specifically says, we don't want to bring this case or proceed with investigations if this would cause any embarrassment to the State Department. and he sort of goes into that's the last thing we want to do. I don't have the response to that letter, but we can assume that state was on board with that. And I think the other interesting thing is certainly through the World War II and the 40s, the State Department worked very, very closely with the SEC on a number of projects. And State and Treasury at that time were, of course, fighting during the World War II period. And so the SEC in many ways found itself between both the State Department and the Treasury Department.
I think it's important. I don't want you to get me wrong here. The relationship was cordial with the State Department. It wasn't that they were standing for something different. It was more a matter of how the process was driven. And the process was driven from the SEC, not from the State Department. So even the legislation that is used to implement a memorandum of understanding is legislation passed by Congress. It's not implemented or overseen by the State Department or from a foreign policy point of view. The judgments that are required under the legislation are judgments by the SEC.
I think I'd like to follow up for a few minutes on the MOUs and then maybe come back and ask a little bit more about the relationship with the State Department, some other intriguing things that popped out of your oral history, Michael. Now, could you tell our listeners a little bit about what an MOU is? I mean, you've said memorandum of understanding. Does that sum it up? Well, is there more there than meets the eye?
A memorandum of understanding that I think really you have to back up for a second, which is the SEC found itself in the following odd position. It had people trading on U.S. markets who were believed to be violating U.S. laws. It did not have the ability to subpoena records from outside the United States, and it needed assistance to be able to do that. That's something that only another country's regulator could do. And it needed to find a method to request that type of assistance. When I first was working at the SEC in the early 80s, there was one treaty that had been negotiated with the government of Switzerland in 1973 and ratified in 1977. The negotiations had taken more than 4 years. It had taken 3 years to get it ratified. It had been used on a couple of circumstances, not terribly successfully. It was complicated. It had concepts in it like dual criminality, which meant that you could only ask for assistance in cases that could be brought in Switzerland and vice versa. And therefore, since Switzerland didn't have any securities laws, it was virtually meaningless. When we used it in insider trading cases, we had to go to the Swiss Supreme Court and explain how insider trading was tantamount to theft. And to build that record, that took years. Yet, from the SEC's point of view, we didn't have years. We were trying to come up with something pragmatic. We wanted to have something that could be built on. I think the school of thought at the SEC was that the markets were evolving at a rapid rate. And if you didn't build a framework that was iterative, that could grow with the markets, that you really would be spending all of your time negotiating over political details that were important to someone, but not terribly important to the markets. And so that when the SEC brought its first cases in 1981 against Swiss banks who had traded on behalf of people alleged to have purchased on inside information, the Swiss Bankers Association actually came forward and said, look, we've got to work this thing out. This is not good for business. And so the discussion began, what is the right format? We've got this treaty. It's not clear that it's going to work because insider trading is not against the law. Let's create an understanding that two people can have a meeting of the minds on that will provide a framework for going forward. Now, in the Swiss case, it was an extraordinary understanding because they not only had to understand that they were going to assist the SEC, but that they were going to assist them in things that weren't against the law in Switzerland. And it required them to change their customer agreements to include an agreement with respect to this. It required all the banks to agree to it. But that really provided the model. And, you know, at the time, we looked at this concept and said, should we have a memorandum of understanding just on insider trading? Shouldn't it be broader? And the conclusion at the time was it would be great if it was broader, but that's not available today. Let's do what we can today, and we'll come and we'll approach the problem tomorrow that we have tomorrow. And people like Ed Green and John Fetters and Chairman Shadd really provided the support for thinking a little less ambitiously, but being pragmatic enough to say, we're going to do something unique here, and signed that memorandum, negotiated and signed that memorandum of understanding. From there, we took the concept of a statement of intent and used it to negotiate much broader understandings. At the same time, it was very valuable that it was a statement of intent, because when we were dealing with members of the EU, who at that time weren't really sure, could they be negotiating these things, or did the EU have to do it, could always say, look, it's not an international agreement. It's just a statement of intent between two agencies. So what really mattered more than anything else was the commitment of the people on both sides. And the negotiation of the MOUs had a lot to do with the words while they were being negotiated, but much more to do with the relationships that were created. The philosophy was one of, if you have two like-minded people who are both committed to building the markets and to enforcing the law as it's understood in this document on the markets, that you can work virtually anything out. And so the documents were really intended to be pragmatic, forward-looking, not an end in themselves, something that could be superseded at any time, and that would really start the ball rolling more than anything else.
Michael, what was the attitude of the French, of the Swiss, especially in terms of giving up long-held confidentiality?
I thought someone must have been very persuasive and persistent.
Well, I think, I think there are two ways of looking at it. The one way of looking at it, both of them are probably right. First, I think the Swiss banks took a very pragmatic view, which was, we have no interest in doing business for people who are violating the law, especially if it screws up our ability to do business in the United States. These were very serious banking entities that were truly international banks in their reach. They did not view themselves as forever small private banks, but rather they were seeing the securities and other business develop in front of them. I mean, one of the defendants in the Santa Fe case was Citicorp. So it was Citicorp Switzerland, but it was Citicorp nonetheless. Union Bank of Switzerland, Swiss Bank Corporation, Credit Suisse. Credit Suisse at the time owned Swiss American Securities, a very large broker-dealer here. So there was, you know, on the one hand, there was, you know, a desire to enter the marketplace and to not have this really be an impediment. On the other hand, you had Judge Pollack, who had ruled in the St. Joe case about a month after the Santa Fe case was brought, another insider trading case, though somewhat smaller, but he ruled in that case it would be a travesty of justice to allow someone to trade in the U.S. markets and then hide behind a shield of Swiss secrecy. This created two problems for the Swiss banks. One, it made them look like they were dishonest. And the second was Judge Pollack said that if they didn't turn over the name, he would fine them $50,000 a day. And, you know, I used to say $50,000 a day isn't very much, but when it's for eternity, it really adds up.
<does. laughs>
And I think that the banks looked at it exactly that way and said, there's got to be a better way.
Now, you said earlier that the original MOU with Switzerland provided that the conduct that was subject to enforcement had to be a violation of Swiss law. Did that work the other way as far as the U.S. was concerned?
No, it actually didn't say that. What it did was it dealt with that problem. The treaty would have required it to meet this dual criminality concept. What happened was, in the Memorandum of Understanding, we negotiated a concept of insider trading. We negotiated very narrowly. It really only dealt with insider trading before takeovers. And it only dealt with getting account information for the 20 days or 40 days, I can't remember which, preceding the takeover. It was focused on the cases that were being brought at the time. It was not focused on a broad international enforcement effort like you see today.
Say today that a foreign country, say Canada, with an MOU with the U.S., asked the SEC to produce whatever it has about conduct that violates Canadian law. Mm-hmm. Will the SEC necessarily and automatically do so?
I believe so. I mean, certainly under the MOU that exists, there's no requirement that it be against U.S. law, as long as it's consistent with U.S. law. So, for example, if they were investigating, and this was a fear when the agreements were first being negotiated, could you have a country say, you know, we're investigating a political offense, but couch it under SEC language and get assistance investigating Americans who were doing something in their country? Then obviously no. But what really is important for understanding the way MOUs are enforced is the way the agreements are implemented. When we went to write the legislation, because the way the securities laws were written, Section 21A said the SEC has the ability to subpoena records for any violations of this title. So a violation of Canadian law is not a violation of this title. And therefore, the SEC actually didn't have the power to compel the production of evidence for foreign authority. What we did was very simple in modifying the Exchange Act. We just broke 21A into two pieces, A1 and A2. A1 was the domestic, and A2 said, shall not violate any provision of this title or something fundamentally the same. And so the words didn't have to match up, but the concepts did. And so as long as it was for investor protection in relation to securities and the securities markets, assistance would be available.
Very interesting.
And a question there. The legislation, I think, was passed 1988. Is that right?
89.
So in the agreements that had been previously negotiated, mm-hmm. did the SEC actually have the power?
No. And if you read the two agreements that were negotiated with both the Canadians and Brazil, part of our strategy was there was enormous interest in Congress on the SEC's enforcement power. Congressman Dingell had held hearings and had asked questions about, well, how are you going to, you know, protect Americans against foreign fraud? And so there was always this idea that we needed this power. But it seemed like, from an organizational standpoint, it was a heck of a lot easier to negotiate the agreement that would be implemented by the legislation than the legislation that would be implemented by the agreement. And so when we went out to two countries that were very interested in having better cooperation with the SEC, Brazil and the Canadian provincial regulators. And we had been discussing with them, well, is there a way we could formulate our cooperation that's purely, in quotes, American, that our markets are very similar. The SEC had provided a lot of assistance through the Inter-American Development Bank to the South American regulators, and that commission had many of its laws were similar to American laws, and the Canadian regulation was similar in many respects. Is there a way that we could bring all that together in agreements that then could be implemented by the change in the law for the assistance? So if you read those two MOUs, and frankly, virtually every MOU that was negotiated into the early 90s, we always built in this concept that we didn't require anybody to have the actual power to implement the agreement as long as they committed to get it. And again, part of this was there was an excitement about building international markets at the time. Countries were committed to having real securities markets. They were emerging everywhere. This was a sign, we believed, of credibility of the market and commitment to investor protection. And I don't think that was, you know, just a one-sided view from the SEC. I think the foreign regulators also viewed it that way, that this showed that there was really an importance to international cooperation. I can't remember if I spoke about this in my oral history, but after the Boesky case was brought, one of the things that we learned as a result of the Boesky case was that he had been involved with a man named Ernest Saunders in the UK, who had been involved in manipulating the securities of a number of companies, including Guinness, in the takeover of Guinness. And shortly after we signed that MOU in 1996, we invited the then solicitor of the Department of Trade and Industry to come visit us and said to him, look, here's the records, here's the documents that show this manipulation. At the time, we thought, you know, we're really helping him out. It turned out that Boesky had been a very small part of the manipulation. But nonetheless, it was, I think, it demonstrated in a very graphical way how important this was.
Just to follow up, I'm curious about whether you had direct contact with the Inter-American Bank.
Yes. The SEC's relationship with the American Development Bank was really a long-standing one. John Evans, former commissioner from the late 70s and early 80s, and Irv Pollack both, had been also commissioner and former head of trading and markets and enforcement, had I think, very close working relationships with the Inter-American Development Bank. There'd been an organization founded in the 70s called IOSC, the Inter-American Association of Securities Commissions, that ultimately became IOSCO, but that had been founded and funded by the Inter-American Development Bank. So, and there'd been a lot of aid given in terms of commissioners having interest in what was going on in those countries. It's interesting. There are a whole group of SEC commissioners from the 70s and 80s. Al Sommer is another one, who throughout their careers were very interested and involved in the writing of securities laws. Al wrote the laws of Egypt, I believe, on an AID mission at one point. So the U.S. approach to regulation was really taken outside of the country by the commission's professionals for a long time. And the IADB was very interested in doing that.
Yeah, Norman Poser in the 1960s spent a year in Brazil working to draft their securities laws.
And that no doubt has something to do with why they were similar. And it did sound as though you were suggesting that the earliest MOU partners might have been selected because of their similarity. Is that generally true?
Yes. I think that the idea, as a negotiator, you'd always prefer to negotiate the model at the front end. And I think that we certainly recognized that we wanted to have a model off of which we could build. So it was easier both because Brazil, not a common law country, but they certainly had the same approach to the securities laws. And so if you were trying to build in broad concepts with respect to offerings and fraud, it was easier to do it with a country that you had shared those concepts with. The UK, we had negotiated in 1986 also a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Trade and Industry. That was much more limited, in part because the DTI at the time, which was just setting up the SIB, was really setting up a platform for overseeing trading, but not the issuance of securities. And so it always contemplated that there would be a broader understanding that would be negotiated, but they couldn't contemplate it, what they didn't have. And so it was one thing to be able to negotiate based on potential ability to provide assistance, but when you don't have the framework underlying that, it would be impossible. So the SEC's view was very much one of we will talk to everyone and we will try to find a basis with everyone. So nobody was told, no, you're not ready.
That would have been a bit rude, wouldn't it? Well, it, from some of the things that you mentioned earlier, including the drafting of the Egyptian securities laws, it seems clear that some part of the OAA's business, and even before that, the SEC's business, had to do with contributing to the learning curve in other countries. And Felice, I know that you've been through a lot of the records here. Do you have anything more that you could tell us about the contributions of the OIA in general terms to learning in other countries?
Well, again, I think there's tremendous precedent for that. And so from the 1950s onward, so when much of the world is emerging from World War II, essentially we see delegations from all over the world passing through the offices of the SEC. That was a stop which people from Pakistan, Liberia, you name the country, would stop and often spend quite a bit of time with the commission. In addition, from the 1950s onward, SEC members were sent out all over the world to, in fact, work on different countries' securities regulation. In Liberia, actually, in the 1950s, there was a member, actually an employee of the SEC, who was sort of lent out to the State Department, seconded to the State Department, to actually work in Liberia to draft their corporate code. My argument is that that was a great part of Cold War policy. It was part of winning the hearts and minds and of spreading capitalism through the world, and a particular type of capitalism. It's not new in the 80s. Again, I think the pace increases, but it had long historical roots. And in fact, although I don't have documents on this, word is that Louis Loss was the first person to go to Egypt to help draft Loss.
Now, that seems to suggest that you do view, and you said it was your argument, Felice, I'm interested in seeing if Michael agrees, that the SEC itself is sensitive to issues of foreign relations that may be peripheral to the strict mission of investor protection. And would you agree, for instance, that the ebb and flow of the Cold War affected SEC policy?
Well, I was there at the end of the Cold War, mm-hmm. So it's really what I would articulate it a little differently, though I think I agree, which is that markets are democratizing. If you view banking as more less democratizing, because bankers decide whether they're going to make you a loan, they tell you the terms that they'll make you the loan on, and then you either take it or you don't, and you pay, or they take your property. Securities markets, you make an offering of your securities. People decide if they want to buy it or not, and then they're buying into your success. They have equity. They don't just have a loan. And they can choose based on the information that they get. And so it creates information flow. It creates openness. It doesn't work if you don't have openness. It doesn't work if it doesn't have fairness and accessibility. Banking is one where bankers always trade on inside information. That's the concept. They get the information. It's mm-hmm. perfectly appropriate. They get the information. They decide if they want to take the risk. Nobody else gets that information because they're not making the loan. In securities markets, it's not that way. And so I think, what we saw, and really while I was dealing with international matters at the SEC, the Berlin Wall fell. We actually went to the week the Berlin Wall fell on our way to Hungary to open the Hungarian securities market. It was the first ringing of a stock exchange bell in Eastern Europe since the Russians had taken over, and they invited us to come. We brought them a replica of the New York Stock Exchange bell, and we went and rang it, and it was a great celebration. I think Richard Breeden, who really, he and Jim Doty and others at the commission at the time, there was enormous excitement about the possibilities of bringing capital markets to these countries as a way of furthering innovation, as a way of helping them work their way out of the issues that they had. The numbers of the finance minister of Russia came to meet with the chairman of the SEC to talk about markets. And it wasn't just in Europe and Eastern Europe. It was Asian countries where, you know, Vietnam and other countries that had been under communist rule. It was throughout Latin America, which at that time was really booming. And there was a huge request from everyone for technical assistance. And I had an official of a country, of an organized country, come to me one day and say, you know, we really view, because the SEC set up an international program to teach securities markets regulation. And he said, you know, we are very sore about the fact that you have this international program, because what happens is these countries come and visit us and they say, well, we don't understand exactly how things work here. How can you be an organized market? You don't have any of the rules that you need. And he would say, well, those are the rules in the United States. And they would say, yeah, that's right. That's what we learned. Those are the rules you need. And so it was both in the U.S. interest to, and I'm trying to get to answer your question, it was broader than the question of just securities markets regulation, in that it was clearly in the interest of the United States to further its own system, in, as opposed to other systems that existed for securities trading. Though it was in the SEC's self-interest, in that the more they were like us, the better the cooperation, the better the possibilities for the markets intertwining. And so I think there was a recognition in a lot of different dimensions that building capital markets throughout the world was going to obviously increase competition, but it also was going to increase the possibilities.
And I think we agree on that. And you can see through the 50s and the 60s very explicitly that U.S. foreign policy was to provide technical assistance. And part of providing technical assistance was work on the markets as much as, you know, water reclamation. So it was a very explicit part of U.S. policy. I think there's a change in the 1960s when money starts to dry up a bit. So there's the income equalization tax, right, which really changes the structure of the marketplace.
But I take it to this day it would still be the SEC that would be providing the funding for the assistance, or does it come from someplace else?
The SEC doesn't have any independent funding for the assistance, so it teaches a couple of international institutes in the United States to which the participants pay their own way. And then it sends people out, often paid for by USAID or other funding sources, the international development banks.
And that was from the 50s or really the 60s, you see USAID, who is in fact supporting these trips and these missions.
You mentioned the International Institute on Securities Market Development. Who developed that idea? When did it get started? Who attends? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, I think, you know, the credit for that institute probably goes first and foremost to Richard Breeden, who, when he was chairman of the SEC, took an enormous interest in a number of the markets that were seeking assistance. At that time, the Polish a man named Leszlo Paga, who was an infectiously interesting man, and Alona Hardy, the head of the Hungarian Securities Commission, and the head of the Mexican Securities Commission, were coming to the United States and talking about cooperation, talking about building their markets. And I think Breeden really saw the opportunity and the chance to become something more than just a one-off sort of provision of assistance. And so we announced that we would have this International Institute as a concept long before we had any idea what we would actually do. But as with all good ideas, we announced it, I think, weeks before we had to do it, so we didn't have much time to really get to worry about it. And we told countries they could send two people. And Richard was really insistent on only two, the idea being that send your two best. And if you it was startling 5 or 6 years later when you would go traveling to other markets, whether it was in the emerging markets like Thailand or in the former Soviet states, you would go see the chairman of the Securities Commission there, and he would have the diploma and the picture of being handed the diploma from his graduation from the SEC International Institute on his wall, usually next to the letter of appointment from the president of the country. And it was really, it sounds kind of corny, but the institute became something special for people. People met each other there, and so it became collegial, but among the markets. It was special because most of the chairmen of most emerging markets had come there at some point in the first few years. And it created for the SEC opportunities that were extraordinary in terms of being really opening itself up and giving people access to the SEC staff to talk about the way markets worked.
Substantively, what did you actually teach at the Institute?
Securities regulation according to the SEC.
So
there was some discussion of philosophy. There was discussion of how you regulate a marketplace, what instruments were. It's an incredibly broad-based 2 or 3 week course that goes through every discipline that's operated within the SEC. And so it was taught by the division directors. It's pretty interesting to go down into a room of 150 delegates from 75 countries who are generally the best and the brightest of those countries trying to figure out how to build their capital markets, talk about yours and get their questions, and to really talk about how it worked and what their problems were and could you help. I mean, there were some things that were just sometimes absurd that you'd be asked. People would talk about how do you tell the difference, what's a good way to organize so you can do your trade matching at the end of the day. How can you match your buys and your sells? But the markets would all come, the New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, other SROs would come, people would come from other agencies. It was a magnet for bringing people in, and it was to talk about the American way. So it was very patriotic in one sense. In the other sense, it was incredibly international, and it was the SEC's.
Now, you used the word patriotic. Felice, the title to your gallery is American Imperialism, and that does... In general, when people use the word imperial, they're not necessarily being flattering. what do you think the intent is there, or could you tell us what the intent is there behind the titling?
I'd point out it's the Imperial SEC question mark. And so I think that the gallery tries to explore this as, in fact, a question. Was there an imperial nature to the SEC? I mean, from the very beginning, I think there was an idea, and I'm talking about by the 1940s when the SEC was only 6 years old, that the American model was going to be the best model. In fact, there was a number of reports that were done in the 1930s about the London Stock Exchange by people who had been temporarily hired by the SEC to go to London, and those reports were too positive. The first report was rejected, and then the second report was rejected as sort of too flattering to the London Stock Exchange and the way the exchange worked. And so my question that I'm really approaching this gallery with is to what extent did it make sense for an American model of securities regulation to essentially be stamped across much of the world? What were the competing models? In what ways was the SEC willing to cooperate? What was the ideology behind cooperation when it did cooperate? What were the politics? And I think the much broader question of the way in which the SEC, which we so often think of as a domestic agency, in fact was really very important in terms of larger foreign relations issues. And so I bring all of those things as a question to this project. one without conclusions right now, and I expect that I will never have conclusions, but as a historian, those are the frameworks that I'm looking at in terms of telling a story about the SEC.
That's an excellent big picture rendition. I have an incredibly picky question. In securities regulation, I typically spend quite a bit of time on the definition of an offer and that sort of thing. And every year it gets a little more complicated. Do you think that the SEC and the OIA now, as part of the SEC, have any interest in putting that fine and imprint on anyone else's securities regulatory system?
I will say that from the 1940s onward, the SEC was taking a very, very strict approach to what it would consider to be an offering. We see that in connection with the foreign debt of quite a few European countries, and then coming out of World War II as you reissued debt. Most of foreign debt was in default at that point, and so it had to be reissued, what they were considering to be an offering. And often that was inconsistent with State Department policy, which wanted to see this finished and done. I'll also make another point, which is that the International Bank for Reconstruction and Redevelopment, a real, the heart of post-war policy that was going to be truly, an international bank that was supposed to stand above all countries. There was a tremendous issue that eventually arose as to whether those bonds issued by the bank and guaranteed by 47 different countries had to be registered with the SEC, with the SEC taking the position that they in fact had to. So I think these issues, of minutiae are quite important, and I would say are actually quite consistent throughout SEC history.
Michael, do you agree with that?
I do. I mean, I come at it from a little bit different orientation because I think you have to look at the motivations that existed within the SEC for coming up with interpretations like that. I think the SEC has always viewed itself as a protector, overseer of a marketplace that is unique. I mean, the United States has more individual investors, more participation in its markets. People look to the markets as a way of getting a return, but also in knowing that they'll get a return. I can remember talking to heads of central banks who would say, if I ask the man on the street, would you like to buy a security or would you like to buy a new washing machine? He'll say, I'll have the washing machine for 10 years. I don't know about this security. I mean, convincing people that they should take a piece of paper or now a dematerialized piece of paper and that they can return it and get money back and that they'll get money back in 3 days and that it will operate, in a predictable way based on information that they have is something, that would be a challenge for Houdini in some marketplaces. And the SEC, I think, has always looked not just at the individual investor, but at the way the system works as being important. And so I think there are principles that underlay a lot of what the SEC does. In this era where we're talking about principles-based regulation, I believe there are real principles that underlay all of what the SEC does generally that, extend to the way they regulate the markets, the way they write the rules, and what they consider to be a security.
That's one of my favorite subjects. How about the definition of a security? Do you think that there is a real drive to uniformity there? Is it a major issue as far as what the SEC might be trying to accomplish to make sure that everybody thinks that orange grow parcels coupled with service contracts might be a security?
I'm not sure this is an international issue, but my own view is that the marketplace has become so highly liquid that there are so many different kinds of instruments that are available, that people are looking at new ways of laying on and laying off risk, that the definition of security will broaden, and it'll broaden, I think, constructively, because it will make more capital available for investment. And that's really, at the end of the day, you know, when we're talking about politics, markets exist only for one purpose, and that's to provide money to businesses to actually conduct themselves in the real economy. There are lots of people who make money trading, but at the end of the day, the success of the market is judged by the success of what underlays the market. And so having laws and keeping the regulation integrated with that very principle is what I think is really so important to the SEC. To digress for one second, I mean, one of the things that the SEC got involved in when I was in OIA was looking at trade agreements. Because, you know, who would ever think trade agreements, securities regulation, what does that have to do with that? Well, there was a real concern that someone might regard trade as that securities regulation is somehow impacting an unfair access to the U.S. markets. We have GAAP. Lots of people have GAAP. They're different, but they're still rules. And if you have trade people running things, they would say, well, everything's regarded as a rule. We don't need to look at the particulars of it. It really mattered to the SEC as a trade matter that regulation be seen as distinct and unique. And so as a result, the SEC was involved in the negotiation of NAFTA and was involved in the negotiation of the free trade agreement for those exact reasons.
But I find that fascinating because, again, that parallels, you know, the SEC being involved with the negotiation of, you know, at Bretton Woods. And again, it demonstrates that the SEC is very much part of larger foreign policy.
Though I will tell you that when we went over to the Treasury Department and announced that we thought we should be a member of the delegation going to talk about the free trade agreement, we were not met with open arms or, you know, a lot of understanding. There was a lot of discussion about why would the SEC have an interest here, and as an independent agency, how could it have an interest here because this is U.S. government policy. But I think at the time there was really an openness because people were looking at markets as being important, and it was clear the other countries negotiating wanted to talk about this. And so the SEC signed on as technical experts, not as members of the delegation.
We have just a couple of minutes left, and I did want to run one last question by each of you quite quickly. That is, what do you think OIA has not been able to do that it might be able to do if it had all the money in the world? That is, what at this point should be on its agenda of things left undone? Felice?
Well, I think this goes to this much broader question of what's currently taking place in the markets and how, in fact, you truly regulate what is a global economy and a deeply interlinked economy. And I think all of those issues in terms of what we understand to be a security, who are the regulators, does national regulation even make sense, go to that broader issue.
I'm going to take sort of the contrarian view, which is the SEC is a domestic securities regulator, and its mission is to protect the American securities market and to make the American securities market the best market in the world. I think OIA creates the opportunities for improving that marketplace. And so it's not a function of how much money OIA has. It's a function of the collaboration that exists within the agency with a vision towards what are markets going to be like in 15 years. And so if you asked me how would I spend that money, I would ask that question. What do investors want? Where do they want to invest, and how do we invest it?
Thank you both so much for your comments and perspectives on the work of the SEC Office of International Affairs. Although it is one of the newer offices at the SEC, it certainly has made an impact over the last two decades and doubtless will continue to do so in the current and future global economy. Our audience may be interested to know that the Fireside Chat is now archived in audio format in the virtual museum, so you can listen again to the discussion at any time. A transcript of the discussion, as well as the chat in MP3 format, will be accessioned in the online programs section in the coming months. Again, I would like to thank Pfizer, Inc. for its generous support for today's program. Please join us again next month on May 20th at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time for our next fireside chat, this time discussing the SEC regional offices. My guests will be two former regional directors, Mary Keefe from Chicago and Michael Walensky from Atlanta. Thank you again for being with us today.